been activated and impassioned by what's been going on in our world. And maybe that kind of activism and compassion can be informed by some of the law and policy surrounding those issues. I'm very pleased to have gathered this expert panel of scholars and civil rights lawyers. We are covering several different areas. The list is exhaustive for the kinds of areas that the Trump administration will have negative consequences, where the Trump administration will have negative consequences. I do plan to organize subsequent events to not only address the issues we covered here in more detail, but additional issues that aren't covered here. Something that was mentioned earlier, a couple of our very close colleagues, our dean is a disability rights expert, our associate dean is a health law expert. Both of them are not here, but hopefully in subsequent events, I will organize events to address those issues, as well as an event focused entirely on democracy and political strategizing for better outcomes. That's another idea. I've also asked the panelists to identify ways that they think that the broader community can help support their social justice work. I'm going to ask them to hold off on those comments until the end. We are going to go through each of the issue areas that the panelists work on relatively briefly, just to provide just a basic foundation, so that we can have enough time for discussion. Let's see. After the panel, we'll have a short break, and we have a cash bar in the back, and so we encourage you all to talk and stay, because there will be a live music program beginning about a half hour after we take a break. I want to thank, I already thanked HR, I think Eric, my brother, right? Bardui and Galari. Bardui, great to show here, Galari, the artist here, of course. All the panelists, the musicians, good friends of mine, who agreed to do this to support this kind of work. And we've had very substantive conversations about these issues. And I want to thank the volunteers, of course. Thank you very much for helping us today. And I want to thank Kelly Coates for the amazing flyer. Okay, with that, I'm going to do very, very brief introductions of each panelist. You can find their bios on the Facebook page. I posted all their names with their URLs if you're curious to learn more about them. So we're going to start with Priscilla Ocean, who's a professor at Loyola Law School, and she focuses on racial justice issues and intersectionality, and she's a critical race theorist.
Thank you to Kathleen and to everybody here at Human Resources for putting together this conversation. I know it's a Sunday night, you all can be anywhere, but I think this is a really important conversation to be having to figure out how we can resist what will inevitably be a series of rollbacks on progress in areas that many of us care about. For me, it's sort of the election of Donald Trump was sort of a shock, but not shocked. For many of us who study history, often when you have significant moments of racial progress, and you know, some folks would certainly count the election of the first black president, more visibility of people of color, people from the LGBT community, people from immigrant communities, visibility speaking out, demanding more equity and justice in this country and in this world. You would counter often, and historically this country has generated significant backlash from whites who feel like their position in this country is being threatened. One thing that came with this election was certainly putting to rest the myth of post-racial America, because race drove, in my opinion, the election of Donald Trump, right? Racial resentment and the notion that people of color, those who had historically been disenfranchised, were being empowered. And looking at the history and seeing the way in which this occurs, it's quite tragic. And so I want to talk a bit about what the impact will be with regard to civil rights and civil liberties, particularly racial justice issues that the Department of Justice typically steps forward to investigate, to prosecute, and to protect people who are minorities regard to race, gender, sexual minorities, religious minorities, language minorities. And I think we're going to be in for a rough 4 years or 8 years. I'm not looking, I wasn't that won't happen, but at least a rough 4 years. So far, Donald Trump has put forward nominees for his various cabinet positions, but in particular, the Attorney General, who has been out and out, been called racist, and for that reason denied things like federal judgeship. Jeff Sessions, who is a senator, a United States senator from Alabama, has been nominated to be the Attorney General. He has made inflammatory racial remarks, has celebrated segregation, and again, for that reason, he was denied a post as a federal judge in 1986, and yet he's fit to serve this country as Attorney General, the chief law enforcement officer in 2016. What does the Department of Justice do, right? The Department of Justice is the main agency that the Attorney General oversees. The Department of Justice is tasked with investigating claims of racial discrimination in police departments and prisons, and my colleague Samantha Buckingham is going to talk more about that. They've been tasked with suing school districts who are engaged in segregation. They are tasked with, and most importantly, I think, ensuring voting rights across the country. And what we've seen is that this Trump administration, will roll back many of the areas where the Obama administration has made significant progress. Obama will be the first president who will leave office with a smaller federal prison population than when he entered it. Mostly this has been due to his policies with regard to nonviolent drug offenders, right? Changing the 1-to-100 crack cocaine disparity, creating a very aggressive clemency program. Under Eric Holder, the Obama administration stopped seriously charging low-level drug offenses at the federal level, declining to prosecute those kinds of crimes, which again increased the federal prison population. And you have Donald Trump, who's essentially saying he's going to do the opposite. Right, he says he's the law and order. He's going to be the law and order president. Right, he has embraced and endorsed stop and frisk. He has said some things like implicit bias, which helps us to understand why people of color, in addition to the structural forms of discrimination, are often disproportionately targeted. Is a form of reverse racism, right? Calling white people racist when in fact that's not what implicit bias does. So that's one area. Criminal justice is one area which will significantly be affected. We can expect that the federal prison population will grow. I also touched on voting rights, right? So during the Obama administration, the Supreme Court in a case called Shelby County versus Holder, struck down a significant provision of the Voting Rights Act, which provided protections for people who live in certain states across the country, and basically made it difficult for those states to play games and to disenfranchise or suppress the votes of people of color in those states. That provision was struck, one of the provisions that made that possible was struck down by the Supreme Court in that case. And so many people across the country are vulnerable to voter suppression efforts. And Donald Trump has signaled through both his Twitter account and his appointments that he intends to not pursue those issues of voter suppression across the country in places like Indiana, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, those states which he carried, which also had very significant pushes toward eliminating those sorts of programs like early voting, requiring voting ID, which depressed voter turnout and voter efficacy among black and brown communities in those states. They are tending to push those even further, right? So Donald Trump has been talking about illegal voting in states like California, which I think signals that he's intending to pursue policies at the federal level and through the Justice Department to basically reduce voting strength of communities of color throughout the country. And so I think that's really discouraging in here. That's an area that we really need to push back on. These two areas of mass incarceration and voting participation. It's a way of shrinking political power of communities of color, excluding us from the basic social compact, and it's something that we simply can't stand for. And so I thank Kathleen for the opportunity to talk about these things, and I look forward to sort of brainstorming about what we can do on the local level. Thank you.
Well, you can hold your applause until the end. Thanks, though, for wanting to applaud. I think that's awesome. It's really loud in here. So we're going to move on to, we're going to move on to Samantha Buckingham, who's a professor, Loyola Law School, and also the director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic, talk about criminal justice issues.
Thank you. I have to say, seeing the number of you who have showed up for this event is inspiring me, gives me a lot of hope, and I'm just glad to know that there are so many thoughtful, interested people out there in our community, and thank you for being here. I'm going to talk a little bit about criminal and juvenile justice in particular, where we're at kind of generally, what some of the disturbing things are that we know Trump has positions on, and some other disturbing things just about his general overall approach, and that should give us some causes for concern. So generally, there are two things that I think are pretty significant. One is incarceration and the rate of our incarceration is something that Professor Ocean just mentioned. And I think that that's a really significant criminal justice issue facing our country today. The other is juvenile justice and the way that we treat kids in the juvenile justice system, kids who have made mistakes. So first, when it comes to incarceration, since about the 70s, we've quadrupled our prison population in this country. And as Professor Ocean said, right, this is one of the first opportunities that we've really seen where there is some meaningful effort to scale back the number of people who are incarcerated. And it's something that's actually gotten across the board support because it's really expensive to lock people up. Right? It's really, really expensive. So a lot of Republicans will be responsive to smart on crime policies. It's also an era where we have seen juvenile justice, which tracks the adult criminal justice system, begin to have some improvements. So when you see the increase starting in the 70s, but when you see the increase in the incarceration of adults, we also see an adultification of kids within the juvenile justice system. So you've all heard that phrase, do the adult crime, do the adult time. Probably you heard this term, the juvenile super predator. Hillary Clinton got a lot of slack for using that, and Donald Trump even commented about that, but I don't think that that comment belies anything other than his dislike of her. So when we saw an increase in transferring kids to adult court and having kids spend more time being locked up. And what we've been able to see recently, right, on the adult level, we see a reduction of incarceration, and what we've been able to see more recently with reforms is that on the juvenile side of things, we've been able to look at the developmental science, what it is that we know about how kids think, behave, and learn. What really the age of being mature adult is, which is like 25 now, right? It's not the line of 18. And so in response to understanding more about the science, we're able to have better policies. So we've seen some attention from the United States Supreme Court recognizing the science of adolescent development and saying, hey, we probably shouldn't treat kids the same way as adults when it comes to extreme crimes and extreme punishment, because there's always some opportunity for redemption there. So that's an area of concern for the future. The general concerns about Trump's approach to policymaking and the influences that he has sought and some of his positions are what I'm going to talk about next, right? We know what makes good policy generally, right? Research, data, understanding people who have a different opinion than you, why they got there, what their experience is, an examination of our own values and what is a core fundamental value for us and how we want to treat others in our society, and then a willingness to experiment and to monitor our progress. So I'll give you a concrete example of what it means to monitor our progress. How many people have heard of this term, the school-to-prison pipeline, right? Something most people have heard of, right? Generally, what sort of ways does our school system function and more kids wind up in the juvenile justice system, more adults wind up in the adult criminal justice system. So in Florida, the state of Florida, several years ago, they decided that they were going to make some recommendations of scaling back zero tolerance policies in schools, policies that would mean if you, you know, did something wrong, you just get kicked out of school right away. And in response to the scaling back of these zero tolerance policies and a specific instruction to refer fewer kids to the juvenile justice system for misbehavior in school, Florida did just that. They referred fewer kids. However, the kids who were referred, more kids of color were referred than had been referred prior to the change in the law. So we saw a law that was changing to try and help the underlying problem, but we have to continue to look at the data and statistics to see that the people who are benefiting are not just the white kids, right? And it's a respect for that level of science, guided by what our values are, that, you know, is a concern for the future. The lack of concern for research and looking next to my colleague, because she's going to talk about the environment, and that's probably the most stunning area where we see a lack of respect for science. But when it comes to criminal justice policies, you know, when we see an approach that is not respecting science, not respecting research, and just sort of this knee-jerk response to what's going on in the world, it's disconcerting. So in the context of stop and frisk, I'm going to talk for a minute about what that is. So I almost just said Terry stop and frisk, because there actually is a law around this. The United States Constitution has Fourth Amendment. It says, you know, all people don't have to be stopped by the police or searched by the police. You have a right to be free of unwanted searches and seizures. And a Supreme Court case called Terry versus Ohio, many years ago, said that you could have a stop of someone and a frisk, a pat down of their outer pockets, if there was something called reasonable articulable suspicion. At the time that the Supreme Court made this decision, pretty much people were getting stopped, people of color were getting stopped all the time without any level of scrutiny at all for those stops. They were getting stopped and they were getting searched. And the law then became, you have to have reasonable articulable suspicion. It's something more than just a hunch. Well, the stop and frisk policy in New York was a policy that was just disregarding this law, this Supreme Court case called Terry versus Ohio. Right, it was saying you could just stop people whenever. And I'm going to look at my phone right now because I'm going to read you some statistics about it. Nearly 3 million people were stopped in a six-year period from 2004 to 2009. 2% of the people who were stopped had weapons on them. 2% of the people who were stopped. Now, that should cause us a lot of concern because that sounds like it's a really bad policy, like not really effective. And yet Trump, in the very first debate, said this is a very effective policy. We should be doing this in Chicago. We should be just bringing this policy all over the place, right? This was great. And that should cause us concern because the people who were stopped more frequently were people of color. And that is the kind of just knee-jerk decision making that is not going to be helpful for us and for our society. So I'm going to stop there and pass it on.
Thank you. What's that?
Thank you.
She's safe. She's safe. Okay.
So, this is Catherine Tricellini, a professor at the Yale Law School, whose expertise is on climate change and the environment.
Thank you. Can you hear me in the back?
Yeah.
I'm going to try standing up and speaking without a mic because I'm used to speaking standing up. If I need the mic, please just raise your hand if you can't hear me. So, what is climate change? If any of you doubt the science, which I'm assuming we don't have that audience here, but I'm happy to talk with you afterwards. Very strong consensus on the science, kind of like smoking is not very good for you. But the cause of climate change is burning of fossil fuels. There are other causes as well. Those are the predominant causes. And there are other things that contribute to it. But what we've been targeting is burning fossil fuels. So you could imagine who might not like policies that limit the burning of fossil fuels or try to reduce them. And I will come back to that. We have a layer in the atmosphere that keeps warmth in. If we didn't, life could not exist on the Earth. The problem is that we are thickening that layer with the greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere. It's getting thicker, we're keeping more heat in. And this is disrupting the patterns that have been in our environment for a very long time. We are now at a level of carbon dioxide that hasn't been in the atmosphere for 850,000 years. There is a delay in the effect. We are not yet seeing the effect of the greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere, although we have started to see some of them, and they're not pretty. Increased severity of storms, very severe and drops of rain, droughts in other areas. Obviously, changing salinity in the ocean, which is from deposits of carbon into the ocean. This kills coral reefs, which are a very important part of the oceans. Rising sea levels as the various snow around the world, various glaciers melt. Another big problem, rising sea levels, increasing storm surges, worse hurricanes. These are all things you might have heard about. Increasing severity of fires. We know this in California, it's a big issue that we face. Increasing number of very hot days, which is a problem in hot places because a lot of people die from heat. It's not something we hear about very much. So this is a very major environmental justice issue because the people who are suffering the most and the most immediately from climate change are the people who are the least responsible for causing it. Our country, I'm sorry to say, with 5% of the world's population, has produced about 25% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The countries who are going to be hit first and worst are low-lying areas, Bangladesh, low-lying areas that are island nations that have to deal with sea level rise, and they're places that don't have a lot of resources to adapt. What's going on with the law? We don't have a lot of law at the federal level to deal with this. You may have heard about the fact, or not, a few years ago, at the beginning of the current administration, there was an attempt to pass a cap and trade program, which I could describe to anyone who's interested later, which was blocked by a Republican filibuster. Even though it did have bipartisan support, that was blocked. What's happened? The EPA has been proceeding under the Clean Air Act because our Supreme Court determined that the definition in the existing Clean Air Act of a pollutant includes greenhouse gases. So EPA has begun through regulation to develop, it takes a long time to do this, but they've been developing regulations for cars, for power plants, to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that they emit. A number of people don't like this. There have been lawsuits. Some people do like it. The folks who believe in the science and are worried about the impacts are very concerned. Trump doesn't believe in the science. This is bad. He is going to appoint the head of the EPA. In addition, because the House and Senate are both in a Republican majority right now. That means that the current administration could destroy the EPA. The EPA is a creature of statute. It is not something that exists as part of our Constitution. The Clean Air Act is a statute. Some of you may remember what pollution was like in LA a number of decades ago, before the Clean Air Act, or at the beginning stages of it. Really, really, really bad. Many days when you couldn't go outside. Similarly, our Clean Water Act, the state I grew up in had a river, the Cuyahoga River, catch on fire in the late 60s. Burned for 2 weeks. That doesn't happen nowadays, and that river is a lot healthier. These things, these protections that helped us get to this point could disappear. The other thing that happened back in December, the world got together in Paris, and we had our first really significant, I mean, there was a Kyoto Protocol in the past, but we had a very significant agreement about limiting carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions from a very large, almost everywhere in the world. Very important agreement, and the U.S. was part of it this time. This was very important because we polluted, doing a lot of pollution, and we haven't been part of the previous agreements. So we joined that agreement this time. Trump's going to back out of it. I would be very surprised if he didn't. They can also dismantle the current regulations for power plants and the regulations for cars. If you need a car, go now while there's still a tax credit for the low-emitting cars. One thing I want to mention is there have been these recent allegations of hacking. And as I said, last time I spoke about this, this is my personal view, not the view of the Loyola Law School. I think the election was hacked. Everybody wondered why the polls said this, 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 and we suddenly got something else. Regardless, there was a lot of support for Trump, which I'm sorry to hear about. But now we're finding out some other things. Who is he thinking of appointing as the Secretary of State, the head of Exxon? What's Exxon's interest? They have been fighting against climate change regulation, tooth and nail, and there is a fabulous movie I encourage all of you to see called Merchants of Doubt, which talks about the work that Exxon contributed to confuse the public about the science of climate change, which is why we don't have the strength of policies that we should. And you will find more Americans than you would find in any other country who have questions about the science. It was a manufactured public relations campaign to confuse people about the science. And how many more? One.
Should I talk now a little bit about solutions?
We can wait.
Okay. So, and Exxon is being investigated by our Attorney General and the Attorney General of New York for putting these falsities out when their internal documents had recognized that this is what the science of climate change was. There are memos that went to the heads saying this is climate change, it's man-made, and so we better be thinking about this when we're looking at our strategy. Meanwhile, they have funded campaigns to mislead the public about climate change. So putting their head in the position of Secretary of State while putting a climate denier as the head of EPA is beyond concerning. It is surreal and something that affects so many different issues. It affects public health, it affects environmental justice, it affects other species as well, and this incredible gift of a planet, wherever you think it came from, whether it was coincidence or from a higher being, it's an incredibly amazing place that we have something that supports our life. And this is a threat to that, and I'm sorry to say that.
Thank you, Kathy. Next we have Carmina Ocampo, the staff attorney at Lambda Legal. She has expertise in marriage equality, LGBTQ rights. She's also going to be talking about reproductive rights. Melissa, who I invited from the ACLU, whose work focuses on that issue, was unable to join us. So Carmina has thankfully taken that on as well.
All right, can everyone hear me? Thanks everyone for coming to what sounds like a legal panel on the apocalypse. experimental as possible to figure out how to resist, how to protect our communities. When we don't have control over Congress, we don't have control over the presidency, we don't have control over the Justice Department, and we could lose control of the Supreme Court and the lower courts. I mean, this is serious. So I'm gonna keep on with the really depressing news here, because we're hitting you with that, and then we're gonna hit you with a solution afterwards. So I'm gonna give everyone a breather from talking about Trump, and I'm gonna talk about Mike Pence, okay? Because I'm gonna talk about LGBT rights and reproductive rights. And Mike Pence has really been an opponent of LGBT rights for a long time. I wish people would ask him about this during the debates, but nobody did. You know, as governor of Indiana, he proposed to divert funding for HIV and AIDS to conversion therapy, to fund conversion therapy instead, which would be therapy to try and brainwash gay people to convince them that they're not gay, they're straight. He also, you know, fiercely tried to defund Planned Parenthood as governor. He disseminated Planned Parenthood funding as governor of Indiana, which provided very crucial HIV testing in the state. And the result of that was that in Indiana, in Scott County, which is a very rural county with very poor people there, had one of the worst HIV outbreaks in decades. And that was because Mike Pence also was morally opposed to needle exchanges. And as a result, that led to this horrible HIV outbreak. And even with the outbreak, he still did not want to allow for needle distribution. And finally, when he did, he tried to put up barriers to other counties being able to have needle exchange programs. Aside from that, he also, in 2015, he signed into a law, a bill, which basically permitted businesses to refuse service to LGBT people based on their religious beliefs. And after a huge public outcry, he amended that, but he still signed that bill into law. So that is who we're dealing with here. So one thing that we are getting a lot of calls at my organization, and one thing we're very concerned about for people with HIV is just what's gonna happen to the Affordable Care Act. President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, and what that did was the ACA said you can't discriminate against people that have pre-existing conditions like HIV and AIDS. They have to be able to be covered by medical insurance. Well, as a result, people who had HIV and AIDS were able to be covered under the ACA and afford very, very expensive HIV medications. And now we have people calling and saying who have HIV, who have AIDS, and they're afraid about what's gonna happen to them. They're afraid about dying if they can't get covered with healthcare if the ACA is gone. So that's serious. And the ACA also said you can't discriminate against transgender people and the medically necessary care that transgender people need. And that was huge. And so if the ACA is gone, that's gonna affect people with HIV and AIDS and transgender people's healthcare and their access to it. So Trump has, of course, said that he wants to, repeal the Affordable Care Act, but since then he's kind of backpedaled on that. He said, well, he likes the provision of the ACA that says people with pre-existing conditions should still be able to get coverage, but he also has just might do away with it. So we really don't know what's gonna happen with that. One thing that President Obama did one thing people also tell us a lot about is that people ask us what's going to happen with marriage equality. Is something going to happen to their marriages? And actually, marriage equality is going to be safe. There's really zero chance that anything can happen to marriage equality, because that was a Supreme Court decision, that's the law of the land, it has the support of the public, so nothing is gonna happen to that. But what could happen is that there could be a rescission of very important executive orders that President Obama issued to expand and protect the rights of LGBT people. One executive order was that he said that said that there's a law that bans federal contractors from discriminating against LGBTQ employees, and that could be rescinded. Another really important one that affects transgender students was that the Obama administration and the Justice Department issued a guidance which said schools and colleges that get public funds must allow transgender students access to restrooms, locker rooms, and dormitories that fit their and match their gender identity as opposed to biological sex. So that was important. And under the Trump administration, that executive order and that guidance could just be rescinded. And even more horrible, the Trump administration could issue their own guidance about what they think schools should do about transgender students. So that would really be horrible. One thing too is that I see in a lot of headlines, you know, because Trump is president, a lot of states, you know, we expect that a lot of states will be emboldened to pass anti-transgender laws and homophobic laws. So in the year after marriage equality, there were 200 laws that were introduced in different states, you know, just in the past year that were anti-trans, you know, that really attacked transgender people's ability to use the restroom and proposed horrible things like a bounty. Like if you saw a transgender person using a restroom, you know, in a public space, that you could go after them and you would be awarded money if you, you know, reported them. So we expect, unfortunately, more terrible bills like that. For example, one bill was already proposed in Texas that would punish teachers who keep the sexual orientation of students private from their parents. You know, and it would force students to be outed. So we expect more, and there's also bills that could be passed or introduced that just would force transgender people to use the bathroom that matches their birth certificate. So that would be incredibly harmful to transgender people. We also expect to see more just religious exemption bills, like the one we heard about in Arizona that was vetoed by Dan Brewer after people protested, but that would just legalize discrimination against LGBT people if you have the religious belief that made you believe that you could do that. So that's what we can expect about attacks on the rights of LGBT people. So now I'm going to switch to talking about reproductive rights, which is just as alarming. You know, I'm going to start out by talking about some great things that the Justice Department and the Obama administration did so we can understand just what a stark reversal it will be now to have the different people that are picked and in power, you know, leading this administration. So the Justice Department supported abortion providers in their really successful challenge against abortion restrictions in the 2016 Supreme Court case, the landmark one, just this year, Whole Woman's Health, which said it was unconstitutional for the state of Texas to have a law that placed restrictions on abortion clinics that basically made it impossible, that forced them to close down and made it impossible for women to get abortions there. So, the Justice Department was supportive of abortion providers. The Justice Department was also supportive of Planned Parenthood, and, the ACA was also required to cover birth control. So now, Trump previously said he was pro-choice, but now he says he has sworn to, appoint a Supreme Court justice that is anti-choice. And also appoint lower federal court judges that are anti-choice too. And Mike Pence also, as I said before, he disseminated funding for Planned Parenthood in his state when he was governor. If Jeff Sessions is attorney general, he opposes reproductive rights. So there's no way he's going to defend reproductive rights. And reproductive rights advocates have condemned Tom Price, who is Trump's pick for Secretary of Health and Human Services, because Tom Price just opposes the Affordable Care Act, and it's likely that he'll rescind, if the Affordable Care Act's rescinded, so will its coverage of birth control. And he's also staunchly anti-choice, and he led an effort to defund Planned Parenthood too. So what we're gonna see under the Trump administration is, we think Roe versus Wade is going to be safe. I mean, you can't take away the right of a woman to have an abortion, because Roe versus Wade has been the law of the land for 40 years. You know, it's precedent, and you know, what could happen is that there could be attempts to restrict abortion in very creative ways that'll come before the lower courts. So what we'll see is that, you know, Republicans in Congress have been trying for several years to pass a national 20-week abortion ban. Congress could also try to pass a national ban on dilation and extraction, which is known as DME, which is the safest and most common method of performing a second trimester abortion. And what we'll see too is that states will be emboldened too to pass horrible laws. You know, we already heard about the Ohio law, which would ban abortion at 6 weeks, and the horrible Texas burial law that said that you have a miscarriage or an abortion, that the remains have to be buried or cremated. Mike Pence actually signed a more strict version of that law, you know, as in Indiana, and that's gonna go into effect. So one important thing, you know, under reproductive rights, globally, Trump could also reinstate the global gag rule, which was a Reagan-era policy that prohibited groups from receiving USA from providing abortions or even counseling patients about the procedure. So as a result, clinics around the world could be forced to close and have decreased access to contraception. And we could also see that, you know, just slowing down or stopping of stem cell research, you know, the promotion of sex ed and abstinence-only programs, and also just more attacks by Congress and the states on Planned Parenthood.
Thanks, Carmina. So we're gonna move on to immigrants' rights and refugee rights. There are several speakers providing perspectives on this issue, and it's not just because I worked on the issue, they're going to have more limited time than the other speakers. But there's a lot of activity around this issue right now, and when we do get to the point where we can share some suggestions for how those of you who are interested in providing assistance and supporting these causes, there are things we can do on a local level, city level, county level, that are relevant to protecting our immigrant residents. But we're going to start with Jenny Pascarella, who's the director of the Immigrant Project at the ACLU of Southern California. She's going to discuss national security, anti-Muslim national security issues, as well as federal immigration enforcement.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's an amazing showing. So I'm going to start with immigration enforcement, and then I'll switch to what we should expect the Muslim community to be confronting. I think along the threat of doom and gloom, we're really feeling that on the immigration side. And one of the reasons for that is sort of akin to some of the things Carmina was talking about. In the realm of immigration, you know, immigration law is federal law. The federal government has plenary power over immigration, meaning it's the federal government's job to enforce immigration law, not the job of states or localities. And as you probably are aware, our immigration law really sucks, and we were never able in the past, you know, 8 years to achieve comprehensive immigration reform to reform some of these laws. And so the laws on the books just are terrible. And what makes this scary is that really the power is all in the hands of the federal government and the administration. So Trump will have the power to immediately roll back many of the things that Obama has done that have protected people and immediately implement his new policies on immigration. So when he talks about sort of this idea of mass deportations, that is enormously threatening because it actually, some of it actually could come to pass. So I want to sort of lay out exactly what we are looking at. I think, you know, you're probably aware of DACA, the program for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's a program that provided a stay of deportation for children who had come here as young kids. That program almost certainly will be eliminated very quickly. Not only did that program provide a stay of deportation, but it also provided work permits for people who received it. And as you probably know, there are many, many, many people in our communities, in our workplaces, who have received this, who are now able to work, go to school, you know, pursue their careers because of it, and they're now looking at not only the fact of potentially having their work permits taken from them, but the potential threat of deportation to countries that they really have never known. So that's one thing. He talks a lot, and I'm sure you've heard the rhetoric about, you know, we're going to deport 3 million criminal aliens. Well, guess what? There isn't such thing. That's just a complete made-up number, right? And his definition, people in his administration, their definition of what is a criminal alien actually isn't criminal at all. What they're talking about is potentially identifying any person who is arrested and making them, defining them as a criminal alien subject to deportation. So let's talk a little bit more about that, because when he talks about deporting 3 million people and this sort of mass deportation that they're threatening, how is that, what's the actual mechanics of that? How does it work? And it's important to understand this because it's not so easy as just federal agents going out into communities and arresting people, right? You might remember under the Bush administration, we saw a lot of like workplace raids where, you know, federal officers would enter a big factory and arrest 300 people or some, you know, numbers like that, round them up and put them in deportation proceedings. Those tactics are likely, we're likely to see those again, but those tactics don't net the kind of numbers that they are talking about netting. Really what that sort of deportation engine turns on is the cooperation that they rely on and that they have relied on under the Obama administration, unfortunately, between federal agents and local police. So digging into that a little bit more, what we saw, and this was initiated unfortunately under Obama, the linkage between the criminal justice system and the immigration system. So starting in 2008, any person who was arrested, their fingerprints shared with the FBI, then suddenly were shared with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. As soon as their fingerprints are shared, their information is looked at by ICE agents, and they're then flagged for deportation. That simple sharing of fingerprint information and person's identity, you know, person's information having entered the criminal justice system, created a massive dragnet for deportation. Under Obama, we saw more deportations than under any American president. We had record numbers of deportations. And this is, for me, having been in this work, and for all of us, it is extremely threatening and scary, this idea that Trump is going to start doing a mass deportation, because we already saw that under Obama. So what we could be seeing is just even more of that. And it will turn on just relying on local law enforcement to do the job, to help them identify people. The other piece of this is they will also be looking to not only use that system I described of the fingerprint sharing and any person who's arrested being identified for deportation, but actually deputizing local agents as federal agents. So deputizing local police, and you may know this from the Sheriff Arpaio, Maricopa, Arizona situation where actual sheriff's deputies were acting as immigration agents. This is a threat to the entire country, that the federal government can be working to pressure and coerce local police to actually take on the role of immigration enforcement. What does that mean for our communities? It means that people are going to start associating, and they already do, but they're going to do it more. Local police, people who are there to serve us, to protect us, to ensure our safety, as enemies, as actual agents of deportation, which means people won't report crimes, they won't come forward, and it will harm all of us, right? There's a lot more I can say about immigration enforcement, but let me just say something really quickly about Muslim communities, because this is also really, really scary, and something that I think we will see very, very quickly as soon as Trump takes power, which is, they've been talking about the so-called Muslim registry. I think very likely what will happen is they will reinstate a program called NSEERS, which was adopted after 9/11 and essentially was a registry of any non-citizen from certain countries. They had to register, but not only that, they were then subject to very coercive, abusive interviews. Where people were forced to they used them to gather information, a sort of a fishing expedition about people in their communities. They used it as a way to scour their own, those people's history in order to find ways to either prosecute them or deport them. There were something like 13,000 people who were deported in the prior iteration of NSEERS because of this. And they used the interviews to coerce people to becoming informants in their own communities. So turning people into informants for the FBI to spy on their own communities and their mosques and their neighborhoods and their workplaces. We are really worried about this because they're likely to make that program a whole lot worse. And then I think one final thing I'll say about sort of the Muslim community piece is that they're talking about extreme vetting of any person who is applying for admission into the United States or who is already in the United States applying for certain immigration benefits. So this means anyone from refugees from other countries who are seeking resettlement in the United States, asylum seekers in the United States who are seeking to become asylees, people who are seeking green cards, naturalization, extreme vetting for people from certain countries, even to the extent of actually banning people from certain countries, from Muslim-majority countries. This is, like, of course, an enormous, enormously concerning and something that we're looking at and preparing to fight back against.
Thanks, Jenny. Of course, there'll be time during discussion to discuss more the enforcement priorities, which we'll continue to cover with the rest of the panel. So now we have Jess Hansen from NILC, National Immigration Law Center. She's Skadden Fellow, and she also works on immigrants' rights issues. So she's going to be discussing state-level protective measures, but maybe some state and then protections as well.
Thank you, and thanks again to all of you for being here. Jenny laid a really great foundation for what I wanted to talk about, but there's one other thing that I wanted to add, two other things actually that I wanted to emphasize. First of all, there's no right to counsel in deportation proceedings. Many of you probably know that in criminal proceedings, if you're arrested and you don't have the money to pay for a lawyer, the government has to pay for a lawyer for you, public defenders. That does not exist in deportation proceedings. And so people are forced to confront immigration court and the government attorneys without any knowledge of the law. And immigration law has been called second only to the tax code in its complexity. So that's one important piece of this puzzle as well. If Trump is talking about a mass deportation, that means massively increased numbers of people in deportation proceedings without a lawyer. So that's a huge problem. And the other thing I wanted to emphasize is the rhetoric in Trump's campaign criminalizing people of color and immigrants is now likely going to become policy. And so this whole felons not families rhetoric, which unfortunately came from President Obama's mouth, he said that, but this whole dividing people in the immigrant community into good and bad immigrants, that's only going to continue. And so on the state level and local level, which my colleagues will talk more about, but on the state level, it's really important for California to be a leader on these issues and a model of resistance against that framing. And so any measures that we do support need to be for all immigrants without conditioning support for our community on whether or not someone has a criminal record. So I wanted to emphasize those two things. And also to make this a little bit easier to understand, and my colleagues may have different opinions on how to kind of characterize this, but from what we've been seeing, there's kind of three types of state level and local level bills to fight back. And I guess I can say in response to like Carmina's comment about how this is a doomsday scenario, states can pass laws to protect immigrants. So that's a good thing. But keeping in mind, as Jenny said, federal law is supreme in the area of immigration. So there's only so much states can do, but there definitely are significant steps that states and localities can take. So three types of laws. One is kind of not only shielding immigrants from ICE, but also ensuring that police and ICE are not tangled up with each other. So as Jenny mentioned, in the United States, local police serve as a force multiplier for ICE. There's only about 6,000 ICE agents in the United States, but there's over 750,000 local police and sheriffs. And so that means, you know, millions more arrests that can lead you into the pipeline of deportation if the police is helping ICE or providing information to ICE. So one of the types of laws is kind of like ICE out of, so for example, I'm part of the ICE out of LA coalition. There's kind of an ICE out of California coalition as well. Another type of law is right to counsel. So kind of providing that public defender type attorney in immigration context. And there's a state law on a bill right now that would provide that in California. And finally, the third type of law is kind of stopping or preventing immigrants from entering the pipeline of deportation in the first place. So these are laws that you might not even think about as being related to immigration, such as decriminalizing marijuana, and in California recently passed, a couple months ago, a gang database bill, which gives people the right to be notified if they're placed on a gang database and right to challenge that designation. So in California, the California Values Act is a bill that was just introduced by the Senate, and that bill would be basically ICE out of everywhere in California, not sharing information, government information with ICE, and police and sheriffs not cooperating with ICE. California Values Act would also declare that California refuses to participate in any Muslim registry or targeting specific religions to be part of a registry or having to comply with certain requirements like the NSEERS program. In the second category, Rights of Counsel, the Due Process for All Act was just introduced in the Senate, which would provide, we're hoping, universal, and by universal I mean not conditioning getting a lawyer on whether or not you have a criminal record, so universal representation for immigrants in deportation proceedings in California. And finally, under the third category, I mentioned a few bills already. I think my time is up, but I'm very happy to talk more about this, and I should also mention that ICE out of LA is working on the local level on some of these issues as well, so my colleagues will talk more about that.
Thank you, Jess. So now, I'm going to introduce them together, because I'm not sure how they're splitting their time, but this is Marissa Montez and Ellie Robinson. They both direct the Immigrant Justice Clinic at Loyola Law School. It's a community-based clinic that, in partnership with Homeboy Industries and Dolores Mission, that serves the east side of Los Angeles, indigent immigrants on the east side of Los Angeles. So they're seeing, of course, a lot of immediate impacts post-election, and a lot of strategizing, doing a lot of strategizing on how to resist on a local level.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. Okay, so we're gonna talk a little bit more, sorry, this is pretty loud. We're gonna talk a little bit more about what response we're seeing in the community and what is really being asked and what are we able to do. Our clinic is actually out in the community twice a week giving free consultation, so we've actually really much seen what is the impact that the Trump election has had on the undocumented community. So we're going to talk a little bit about DACA first, because we actually serve a lot of undocumented youth. So I'm assuming you guys are all familiar with the term Dreamers and DACA, correct? I know Jenny provided us with a little bit of a background. But just to reiterate, DACA was actually created through an executive action or executive order by President Obama. It is not permanent law per se. For example, immigration law is actually invested in the power of the legislative branch, Congress. So they are the ones who can actually push forward for reform. DACA in itself does not give anybody some form of legal status. All it does is deferment from deportation and gives you a work permit. But since it's an executive order, it can be easily be taken away. And what have we seen that Trump has said? He said that he's going to put an end to DACA. Now he's kind of saying, well, I'm going to figure something out for the Dreamers, but we're really not sure. Luckily, what we have seen is a lot of bipartisan support, especially with the introduction of the Bridge Act, which was introduced by Republican Senator Graham, which would basically give Dreamers, or DACA recipients, extended provisional status for 3 years. But we're not sure what's actually going to happen. So what are we actually advising Dreamers? Or students who are documented, I should say. First, if you have not applied for DACA and you're submitting an initial application, we're telling you to hold off for two reasons. One, if DACA is actually ended, is put to an end, you've submitted your application, you are then out $465, which could be a lot for a student. Two, we're really not sure how this information is going to be shared, so we might as well just wait until what we see what happens after inauguration. Two, if you have DACA, renew it now. It kind of, in a sense, is like, well, your information's already much out there. These applications renewals are getting processed a lot faster. And that way, you at least have an extended valid work permit, because we're not sure if DACA is actually put it to an end, what Trump will say, if it means just let your work permit expire, or you'll be able to renew whatever. So we just recommend if you're able to renew, do so now. Also, if you have DACA, you can actually apply for a work permit through something called advanced parole. The application does take a while to process, but if you are a current documented student and you have advanced parole and you haven't traveled, travel now and come back immediately, especially before the inauguration, because again, we don't know what's gonna happen. And the reason why we say that is because if you're able to leave the country with advanced parole and re-enter the United States, you now have a lawful entry that can benefit you in the future and probably obtaining something a little bit more permanent. If you haven't applied for advanced parole now, we also recommend to just hold off just because you'd be allowed a loss of money, and we're not sure if you'll actually be approved by the time the new administration takes place.
I'm going to talk a little bit about community response. I'm really glad that Jess and Jenny laid a bit of a framework for all of you to understand the fact that our fears are very real when it comes to the immigration machine, the deportation machine that we can expect. Because it's as simple as a policy memorandum. It doesn't have to be a law. I think that's what distinguishes our field from the other speakers, is that, you know, in order to really change things that are statute, the statute has to be repealed, it's a bit more of a legal process. A policy memorandum is just that. The president can create a policy and that policy can be enforced, and that would be the mechanism by which deportations are kind of put into action. Our community does on some level understand this, and as a result, we've seen more than a 3x increase at our community settings. We have so many people coming to the community for consultations that we literally cannot see everyone, even when we take out all of our attorneys and additional trained volunteers. So while we are training additional volunteers, it's important to keep in mind that grassroots service providers offering one-on-one legal consultations and direct representation are very strained and are only going to become more strained. We also are getting an overwhelming number of requests for Know Your Rights workshops, so preparing people for raids, preparing people for family safety plans, making sure that people know where their kids are going, what phone calls are going to be made. So while we're doing that, and all of our colleagues are also doing that, those requests are through the roof, and they're very essential and important because these threats are very real. The community is very scared, and this is a scary time for us as immigrant rights advocates, because this is the first time that we can't really say exactly what's going to happen to them. We can say, okay, well, we know based on the people that are being appointed that these are likely to be the policies that are put into place, or these were the key points of the presidential platform. So we know that 2 to 3 criminal immigrants, as Jenny said, we don't have 3 million criminal immigrants, are our first targets. So we know that to be our front lines of defense. But what we don't know is exactly how these plans are going to be rolled out. So civic engagement is very key right now.
And just something else to say, like all of us as service providers, especially in the nonprofit realm, are very strapped for resources. And the demand is obviously growing because of the fear, and it will likely grow again just because of enforcement. But it's also going to be a loss of resources on our end. Many nonprofits in the local area do receive some sort of funding from the government for unaccompanied minors. That's actually being threatened to be taken away. And also states, you know, Trump has said that, you know, he's not going to give funding to states or recognize the sanctuaries, and there is some state funding for immigrant rights work that will likely be eliminated. So what we do recommend, you know, people tell, like, well, what do you tell your undocumented community? What do you tell your clients? Number one, don't be afraid. You know, we tell them, yes, changes are to come, but the government moves really slowly, and take advantage of this time to prepare yourself. Educate yourself as to what reliefs you may qualify for. If you qualify for reliefs, apply for them. If you don't qualify for reliefs, prepare yourself. Know your rights, as Emily mentioned. Also prepare yourself for worst case scenario. If there's an actual raid that happens, have a safety plan. Where will the kids go if you have, if you have children? And also, who should be your main point of contact in the event that you are detained? And lastly is become civically engaged. Even though you are undocumented, you still have a voice, and we recommend that you participate and be out there and really, you know, push forward to make sure that some sort of, that your rights are respected and that our community is respected.
Final points on local measures that we're taking as an immigrant rights community. We are working to try to reform Special Order 40, which is LAPD's special order, which basically says no collaboration with ICE. We are basically pushing for very concrete deliverables and a reporting system, so if there are violations, there's actually accountability. At this point, just saying you're not going to collude when agents will do what they will is not very helpful. We're also pushing the Sheriff's Department for an articulated and concrete policy. Very importantly, we're pushing the mayor's office to basically lay out a plan of action with concrete deliverables about what we can expect from the different branches of Los Angeles City. And then another thing to really push for as advocates, I know universal representation has been mentioned, there is a bill on Governor Brown's desk. The County Board of Supervisors has been pushed for universal representation as well, but that form of universal representation is really for detained individuals. And while that's very important because there are going to be raids and more people will be in detention, more people will just be in removal, not everyone can be detained. So it's very important that there's a right to appointed counsel for everyone in deportation proceedings, not just those who are in detention. So that's another action that we're hoping will gain momentum.
Okay, thank you, Marissa and Emily. We're going to turn to the initial question that I raised, suggestions from our panelists about how those in the broader community can meaningfully support these efforts. I have one suggestion that ties to local efforts to resist immigration enforcement. It's happening now. I recently resigned police commissioner. We have been working with the LAPD and the city to put pressure to revamp Special Order 40. We need a LAPD policy that is specific as to guidelines for what non-cooperation means. So specific guidelines that prevent LAPD from cooperating really under any circumstances with immigration and customs enforcement. I plan to compile the suggestions that are made on this panel, including the one that I'm referring to now, create a document that I'll post on the Facebook event site. A letter writing campaign, I think citywide residents that support these efforts to keep our city as a sanctuary city, to prohibit LAPD from cooperating with immigration and customs enforcement. I think that's going to make a huge impact on the mayor's office and the city. But now I'm going to turn it over to Priscilla. We'll hear more in terms of suggestions.
Thank you. So, you know, the results of this election were driven by xenophobia, misogyny, and white supremacy. We just need to say that. And so we need to make it clear that we will not cooperate with injustice. That's just point blank. And how do we do that? It means organizing for the 2018 election at the local level, right? So that we can have roadblocks in both the Senate and the House to make sure that Donald Trump can't effectuate his agenda. We need to not cooperate with injustice. And what does that mean? That means we need to demand that our Attorney General do more to stop police brutality and violence, because we're not going to be able to count on the Justice Department to come in and investigate departments like they did in Baltimore and Ferguson. And we're going to need attorney generals across the country to do that kind of work to ensure that people of color aren't summarily abused and killed by law enforcement. We need to resist inequality at every turn. What does that mean? It means that we need to know what's happening and have a historical context. That means we need to read. Read people like Hannah Arendt, who wrote about totalitarianism. Read people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote about the resistance to Reconstruction and the ascendance of white supremacy and Jim Crow. Read people like Derrick Bell, who talks about how racism is embedded in our constitutional democracy. Read people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who has a great book. Read people like Kimberly Crenshaw, who talks about the intersection between race, gender, class, and how power operates in so many of our communities. Lastly, we need to act hyper-locally. That means in our communities. And we cannot allow white supremacy or the terms that they're using to describe themselves, like alt-right and so forth, to be normalized, right? We have to disrupt that kind of language and that kind of ideology, however it appears, if it's in our families, if it's in our friendship circles, if it's in our schools, if it's in our workplaces. You need to stand up and disrupt it, right? Because we need to act locally and think globally. That's the only way that we can really resist this tide of venom and horribles that Donald Trump's election has released. So I'm concerned about his presidency, but I'm also concerned about the people who have been emboldened by him.
Amen. Donald Trump has said in the article something about making America again, America deserved. And in his book, he said that he didn't agree with social scientists and criminologists who link childhood maltreatment, kids who are abused, neglected, experience trauma, and poverty with crime. So going back to my earlier theme of the importance of research, why reading is so important, about 90% of people in our criminal justice system are so poor, they're considered indigent, and they get appointed a lawyer. If that connection of poverty and crime doesn't just like smack you across the face and tell you that there is a huge connection, it's shocking. So we should be concerned about public defense in the United States of America. Yes, you are entitled to a lawyer if you are poor and accused of a crime. However, we know that Giuliani is one of Trump's buddies. Not only was Giuliani a proponent of policing policies like stop and frisk in New York, Giuliani also systematically defunded the public defender, the legal aid society in New York, as part of his approach to handling crime. We know that Trump is reliant upon him, and certainly somebody who he was closely affiliated with in his campaign. So we should be concerned about funding for public defender's offices. If that's an issue that concerns you, I encourage you to look at an organization called Gideon's Promise. They train public defenders in the South and across the country, but particularly in places where our criminal justice system is the most racist. And it's racist everywhere, but in places where it's the most racist. I also encourage you to just listen for a moment as I tell you what the agenda items are for our current Office of Civil Rights Special Litigation Division. I guarantee you none of these are going to be on the agenda once Trump takes office. So these are all the causes. This should be your guidepost for what it is that you get involved in, what it is that you want to donate your time and energy to. One, the rights of people in local or state institutions, including jails, prisons, juvenile detention facilities, and healthcare facilities for persons with disabilities. So the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is going around protecting people in our institutions. Second, the right of individuals with disabilities to receive services in their communities rather than in institutions. Third, the rights of people who interact with state or local police or sheriff's departments. Four, the right of youth in the juvenile justice system. Five, the rights of people to have safe access to reproductive health care clinics. Six, the right of people to practice their religion while confined to state and local institutions. Our new Office of Civil Rights isn't going to have the same agenda, so that's a great place to look at if those are values that you have. To look at organizations that you would want to support. And I'm happy to give you suggestions for more specific organizations.
I'm going to stand up again. It's your talk. So since I'm the one who told you about Armageddon, and you've also heard a lot of, there's a lot of other things to be concerned about, I just want to mention a couple things about how to stay empowered in a time like this, because it's depressing. And you might want to just binge watch something. And I occasionally do want to do comedy. But there's another thing that I think can help all of us stay empowered, which is we all suffer from existential crises sometimes. What's my purpose here? We have a purpose, and it's pretty clear. There are people who came before us that fought really hard to get some baseline things. The work was not finished, as we know, because of problems, but they established some baselines that we thought we were going to be building on. Well, looks like we need to go back and take up the mantle of some of the work that they did before and make sure we don't lose those things. And as far as I'm concerned, these issues are all linked. In particular, voting rights is linked to talk a little more about that, because I know the most about it. municipal voting systems. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals recently said that the way the voting system was changed in North Carolina by the state legislature was surgically targeted to block black voters, to disenfranchise black voters. They blocked a bunch of people, cut them from voting, and there are consequences for the whole country of that. So concern about voting rights, what can you do about that? You can go and help register voters. There are voter drives to states that are not secure in their voting systems. In California, you can help protect voters here. You can go to Nevada, you can go to Arizona. If you have the resources or family, go to Florida, go to North Carolina, go to Pennsylvania. Help protect the voting rights of people in these other states. And it's normal people who do this. Normal people made all these things, the good things in our country happen. And it's normal people like us who can make a difference. Also, you're getting a perspective on law, but law doesn't happen in a vacuum. We need artists. We need people from all different professions to communicate through their specialties about what truly makes America great, which is having a community that respects everyone, that respects our earth, doesn't buy into this crap that there's a conflict between the economy and the environment. Our economy is built on our environment, and that cares about social justice. That's what makes us really great. So that message needs to come from so many different perspectives, and I'm sure many of you are able to bring that in a way. So I just want to encourage you to do that in whatever your field is. This is very importantly, a rhetoric discussion. There's a lot of nasty rhetoric that needs to be countered with other kinds of rhetoric. On Twitter, if you're good on that, and I'm not, but if that's your, you are, that's great. Facebook, whatever else you use. And there are a few organizations that you can support. I want to say the Union of Concerned Scientists. They were attacked by Exxon for outing the work that Exxon did to mislead the public on climate change. So Exxon sued them, got their friends in Congress to subpoena the Union of Concerned Scientists. They were trying to shut them down. Other great environmental organizations, Center for Biological Diversity, Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, I can tell you about more, support them. All these places are going to need money to fight. And don't beat yourself up about little stuff. We got bigger problems. We got big, so keep your focus and keep your community of support.
This is a hard time, and it's a really good time to connect with elders that have just survived harder times. And I'm going to start off with a quote from just an African-American trans elder who is very inspiring to me. Her name is Miss Major, and she heads the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project in Oakland, which organizes and works with incarcerated trans people. And she said the day after the election, she said, "We've all been knocked down, just don't stay down. Get back up and fight. And if you can't get up, then tag someone to jump in and fight in your place. Never give up, never say quit, never say die." So, there's many things we can do, and one thing is to share resources and support for people who've been on the ground organizing to stop deportations, homophobia, and transphobia for a long time. You can support people of color fighting police brutality, deportations. Really, we all are in positions of privilege. Do your part to help the most vulnerable members of the LGBTQ community. You can donate to support groups that organize and provide services to, very poor queer and trans people or queer and trans people who are in detention or in prison. And some of those groups are the Transgender Law Center, the Sylvia Rivera Law Project,
Southerners are on a new ground, which